chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, time and no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Well, the riots over in France are continuing, and here's a report from Paris about the riots that are continuing there in France, and they're breaking out in some of the other major cities in France. So here we go with a report from Paris about the riots created from the killing of a young 17-year-old teenager in France by the police.
Here in Paris, there is currently a sense of calm, but we're all waiting to see if this is the calm before the storm. Even here in the center of Paris has been scenes of disorder, and that disorder is expected to shut down Paris tonight. There have been calls by the government to shut down the bus and tram services tonight, not too long from now. Furthermore, we're expecting to see 40,000 officers deployed to the streets to stop the scenes that we've seen since Tuesday. It was on Tuesday when 17-year-old Nahal was driving a car in a bus lane and was stopped by the police. When he tried to flee, according to the official accounts, the police responded with a fatal shot. Supporters now are calling for vengeance, but it's important to add that there are also historic cases driving the protests and disorder that we have seen. This is a new flashpoint built on old wounds driven by historic senses of racial inequality and injustice. There's also a sense of concern with the political backlash from both the centre and the right towards multiculturalism. And of course, there are also global parallels. In England in 2011, we had the riots following the shooting of Mark Duggan. And more recently, following the killing of George Floyd in the US, which started waves of disorder and a huge international movement. Here in France, we're waiting to see what the global impact will be. But in the short term, with the summer here, the schools out and the weather warm, when will this sense of disobedience and disorder come to an end? The third night of sustained violence between police and protesters, the most intense so far. It began in the Parisian suburb of Nanterre over the police killing of 17-year-old Nahal, who was of North African heritage. Police clashed with citizens following a vigil for the teenager. Cars were burned, streets barricaded, and objects hurled at riot police in an outpouring of rage that could not be ignored. The violence started 3 days ago in the northwest of the capital, where a police officer shot the teenage boy dead during a traffic stop. Following the outcry over his death, rioting and disorder spread across Paris, including protesters lighting fires at the city hall of Clichy-sous-Bois and setting a bus depot ablaze in Aubervilliers. The clashes spread across the length and breadth of the country, from Lille in the north to Toulouse in the south. According to the Interior Ministry, 79 police posts were attacked, as well as 119 public buildings. Overnight, well over 800 arrests were made and at least 200 police officers injured, leaving France in the grip of a national crisis. President Macron hurried back from an EU summit early to chair his second emergency cabinet meeting in as many days. No doubt stung by criticism that he spent Wednesday night at Elton John's concert rather than dealing with the crisis. He now faces calls to declare a state of emergency, as President Jacques Chirac did in 2005 when riots in the capital raged for 3 weeks. But in 2005, social media was not as pervasive. Now President Macron is at least in part blaming copycat violence by teenagers organized online.
Enfin, Social media platforms play a significant role in the events of the past few days. We have on several of them, Snapchat, TikTok and several others, both the organization of violent gatherings and a form of mimicking of violence, which among the youngest leads to a feeling of unreality. It sometimes feels like some of them are experiencing in the streets the video games that have intoxicated them.
The officer who fired the deadly shot today has indicated that he will plead not guilty to a homicide charge, but has offered his apology to Nahal's family. But many public figures are calling for justice above all.
Today, calm would not happen if there are no political decisions or actions. We need political actions on the question of police violence. Justice has to be served, that's for sure.
A UN spokesperson for human rights has asked the country to address some of its issues with law enforcement.
We are concerned by the killing of a 17-year-old of North African descent by police in France on Tuesday. We note that an investigation has been launched into alleged voluntary homicide. This is a moment for the country to seriously address the deep issues of racism and racial discrimination in law enforcement.
Authorities are bracing themselves for more trouble over the weekend, with Marseille, France's second largest city, now banning public demonstrations. The Interior Minister has asked for all bus and trams to stop throughout France at 9 o'clock tonight. But the fear that trouble will continue and even intensify further is thick in the air, especially as social media fans the flames. Now, unquestionably here for those taken to the streets, this is a matter of racial injustice and police racism. But the government here have hit out at that. This is what they're saying. They say that accusations of systemic racism or discrimination by the police in France is totally unfounded. The problem here is that for those preparing to take to the streets again tonight, they do not agree or accept with that in the slightest. Studio.
Thanks, Simeon. Well, joining me now is Juan Branco, a civil rights lawyer from Le Crin, a coalition of anti-racist campaign groups in France, now bringing a civil case against the French police over the death of 17-year-old Nahel. Juan Branco, what do you make of that denial by the French government that there is a problem of systemic racism in the police?
Everyone is conscious in France that France is a segregated country in which there is two parallel societies, one which lives in the suburbs, which is from certain origins, from a part of it, which from Northern Africa and Africa, and a very conservative and protected white elite that lives in the center of the city of Paris. This is for the main central Parisian situation, but you can see a similar configuration in the main cities of France, in Bordeaux, Lyon, Toulouse, and so forth. And then, of course, you have other kinds of social problems in France, but this one is a key one. And, of course, police is at the center of this problematic, and police is being asked to provide with solutions to this crisis and to this political segregation. And there is, of course, an impossibility to use police in order to create a solution for that. There has been no political answer in the last 72 hours from the government, only calls for peace or order, depending on which government, which minister would speak. But this shows that there is a clear denial of reality that is extremely problematic.
So do you think this is going to go on and get worse?
It's complicated in a frame in which there is no political leader that actually is protecting the interests of this population to actually see a political movement start from here. But what is certain is that the violence will continue today and for the next days, because what we're seeing today is like a complete decompensation, in a sense, of part of the society which has decided to not even call politically for anything but just to destroy and produce violence in order to be heard and respected at last.
Now the parallels between this police killing caught on camera and what happened to George Floyd in the United States are inescapable, but in that case we saw outrage and anger across the world, really, across all sections of society. Is the whole of France outraged by this killing, or is it only part of France?
Not at all, and it's a huge problematic in France. You have an important dimension of French society, which has been nurtured and nourished in the last years by racist and discriminatory discourse, which considers that either this killing was justified or at least that there was some kind of protection that should be attributed to the police. And we're finding ourselves in a situation in which I wouldn't speak of civil war phenomenon or even climate, but there is a clear, again, segregation in terms of opinions, and I mean that translates in opinions. And we see a capacity of empathy towards this 17-year-old child, which is very limited by part of the population, also because violence has been increasing in the last years in France. There is a huge crisis of the state in France and of its capacity to actually maintain its authority over the whole territory, and it has created a lot of suffering and a lot of these discourses which opportunistically take advantage of this situation to put the blame on either immigrants or people from second or third generation.
And why are you bringing a civil case when there is a criminal case? Is it because you don't have confidence in that?
To be more precise, we're participating. I mean, there is a provision in the French criminal law which allows us to participate in the criminal case as a partie civile, as they call it. So both cases will be connected, or are joined, both the civil and the criminal case. But our organization is legally authorized to participate as a victim because we consider that this is a racist crime. It is linked and caused by racist either motives directly from the person or either structurally because of the situation, because once again, most of the victims of police violence are either politically identified in France, for example, with the Yellow Vest movement, either racially discriminated. So we consider that this is the case, and the law authorizes us to participate in these proceedings, and we will be following and making sure that justice will be served not only for the family of Nahel, but also for all the people who are suffering from these discriminations.
Juan Branco, thank you very much for talking to us.
This seems to be worldwide now. It seems to be breaking out. But Paris and, France in the last couple of years has had quite a few protest movements over different issues. And they get into the streets over there in France very quickly. Coming up next is a report about the Supreme Court rulings that occurred this week. And some of these are upsetting the liberal left, and boy, they're mad as hell. But here we go with a Fox report about the recent Supreme Court rulings, and they're very, very insightful. And some favor, I guess most of them favored the conservative right. Here we go next.
Alicia, the Supreme Court handing down a slew of major decisions this week, as Alexandria just covered. Now for a closer look of what these cases mean, joining us is Jonathan Adler, a law professor at Case Western Reserve University. Jonathan, thank you. Let's go right into it, but we've got on our board for us so you can see this is that 6-3 split court. We can put here the liberal judges, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, and of course the six conservative justices led by Chief Justice John Roberts. And it was in the three cases, as Alexandria laid out, in the student loan forgiveness case, the LGBTQ case out of Colorado, and the affirmative action case, that this court ruled that way. Before I get into the details of the court itself, we're already seeing headlines, Jonathan, that this conservative court, the Roberts court, is remaking American society in its conservative view of the world. What do you say to that?
Well, I think those claims just simply aren't true. If you look at the behavior of the Supreme Court since World War II, the Roberts Court overturns prior precedents, modifies prior precedents, and strikes down legislative enactments less often than the Warren Court did, less often than the Berger Court did, less often than the Rehnquist Court did. So just in terms of looking at how often the court is changing the law in that sort of way or rejecting what legislatures do, this court is far less active in changing the law than its predecessors were.
Now let's go to the most recent one. Of course, that is the student loan debt. The court essentially ruling, saying that no, the executive branch does not have Congress's power of the purse. And you can see some of the history we have here on the screen. What do you make of this ruling?
Well, this ruling is one of a series of rulings where the court has emphasized that the executive branch has the power that Congress enacts and gives to the executive branch. The president doesn't just get to create a student loan program or a student loan forgiveness program on his own. Rather, the executive branch and the Department of Education executes the laws that Congress enacts. And just like we saw in a big environmental case last term, the court is reminding both Congress and the president that Congress enacts these sorts of laws. The president then gets to implement them. And it's one thing to make slight modifications about what sorts of forms you submit or when they're due. It's quite another to literally remake the entire program in order to create $400 billion worth of debt relief.
Hey, Jonathan, we saw President Biden yesterday saying that he believes the court misinterpreted the Constitution on this case, and they're going for Plan B. We don't know what Plan B is going to look like, but do you believe that possibly if they attempt another version of what they did here, perhaps in a more narrow scope, that that will be challenged in courts as well?
Well, it really depends on how they do it. If you recall when the Department of Education had delayed when payments were due and had paused the accumulation of interest, those weren't challenged. A more narrowly targeted plan that uses clearer authority that Congress has enacted might well withstand any challenge. As the president has also acknowledged, doing alternative routes requires going through a greater administrative process than we saw here, and that creates the opportunity both for people to raise concerns about the plan as well as for the government to make sure that what they're doing is legal. It's actually a more regular use of executive power than what we saw with this plan.
Let's go to that case of the web designer in Colorado. 6-3 was the decision in that case. And Sonia Sotomayor, I believe, was a dissent on that, saying essentially that this ruling now gives businesses license to discriminate against LGBTQ folks. What is your reaction to this ruling?
Yeah, I really think that's a misreading of this case. I mean, in this case involved a web designer, someone who's creating web content, something we all recognize is expressive activity, is the sort of activity that's covered by the First Amendment, just like a television broadcast or a radio show or a newspaper or a blog. And what the court said is that the government can't compel somebody engaged in that sort of activity to communicate or express a point of view or a perspective that they don't agree with. So even this particular web designer, she can't discriminate against who hires her. When someone contacts her to create a website, she can't say, no, I don't like you, or I don't like some characteristic about you, so I will not work for you. She's merely been given the right to say, I'm not going to create a message, create a form of expression
right.
that violates my beliefs. That's a core First Amendment protection against compelled speech. And I think that's really all the court did in this case.
Let's go to the affirmative action case, clearly one of the most consequential of the Roberts Court so far. Your thoughts?
It's a very big case, a very big decision. What the court essentially did here is say that the way universities like Harvard and the University of North Carolina and like a lot of universities are – the way they are using race goes too far. It relies upon stereotypes. It has negative consequences for many applicants, in particular Asian applicants. And the court said that that's just not compatible with prior precedent on either the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment or Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and that it's one thing to look at applicants as individuals and look at their experiences and their background and see if that's something you want at your university. But to make broad generalizations about applicants based on their race the court held, is not consistent with prior precedent and not consistent with federal statutes or the Constitution.
And just in the last case I want to touch on before we run out of time, you can see the court was 9-0 on that postal worker who simply believed it was against his religious beliefs to force him to work on Sundays. 9-0. Did they get it right?
I think they did. I mean, this case, there was some language in a prior court decision that had suggested that anything more than de minimis that an employer has to do is an excuse not to accommodate an employee's religious practices and religious faith. And the court basically said that look in context and look at what the law says. Lower courts had overinterpreted that language, that employers can be expected to take reasonable steps to accommodate the religious beliefs of their employees. In this case, it was an employee that didn't want to work on Sunday, but this will apply to people of all religious faiths, and it basically restores the underlying principle that employers can be expected to take reasonable steps, but if it's a really costly accommodation, well then the employer doesn't have to do that.
Professor Jonathan Adler, great insight as always. Professor, thanks for taking time. Have a great weekend.
So there you go for the Supreme Court rulings. Anyway, we've got two clips next from David Icke. And one sort of an introduction to this, I'm going to put this up and embed this in the my page this time. So come in to thesecrettruth.com, and you'll be able to hear the whole report from David Icke about the smart grid, the control grid. But there's going to be the first clip, sort of an introductory, leading in and sort of talking about the Sabbatean cult and so forth. And then there's a second clip that expands on what's going on about who's really behind some of these Sabbatean cults, control group, and how it functions a little bit better. And then you can come into thesecrettruth.com and listen to the whole lecture by David Icke about the control grid. But here we go with sort of an introductory first 9 minutes of that pronounced speech. Here we go with David Icke.
In connecting Israeli tech companies, and a lot of people won't know this, but Israel is becoming a major, major global center for the whole tech, smart technology arena. And she connects these various companies into a vast web. And they are connected themselves into the, not just the Israeli government, but the Israeli military and intelligence networks like Mossad and the domestic version Shin Bet. And there is a particular military elite cyber unit called 8200 or 8200, whichever name you want to give it or pronounce it. And they are based in a place called Beersheba. Beersheba is where the Israeli government military intelligence has built a vast cyber center. And, you know, if you criticize Israel online and you get the abuse back, a lot of that abuse is actually coming out of Beersheba. And this whole 8200 and other connecting companies and groups have set about taking control of this whole smart technology network, which it goes under the name of the smart grid. And the area they absolutely focus on is something called cybersecurity. And that's very important and very relevant, because when you are employed by the American government, the American military, the Pentagon, the American intelligence network, and whatever like that around the world, when you are writing programs to secure computer systems, you have to have access to everything. The whole system in all its detail, or the passwords, the codings, everything. And there's another area which connects into this, which I talk about in my book, The Trigger, where I go into this in great detail, which is called enterprise architecture. And that means that you can have ongoing real-time access to these computer systems. And through the codes that you write in the cybersecurity area, you can put back doors into these systems through which you can access them. So you write a cybersecurity program for, say, the Pentagon or the White House or whoever, and you can write into that program hidden back doors which allow you to have ongoing access to that data in real time. And as I describe again in great detail in The Trigger, this is fundamentally how 9/11 was pulled off, not by 19 Arab hijackers who were supposed to fly wide-body jets when they couldn't fly one-engine Cessnas, but by hacking in through these back doors in the way I've described into the computer systems of the American government, the Pentagon, particularly the Pentagon response system to hijacking through an organization called NORAD, and also access to computer screens being seen by the civilian aviation administration air traffic system. And the control was such that in real time, they had the ability to put blips on the screen of planes that weren't there and take blips off the screen of planes that were there but were no longer visible. This is the scale of manipulation potential that we're talking about once you can put these back doors into these systems. So what Whitney Webb has been writing about at length is how these Israeli cybersecurity companies that operate as one web and then lock into the military intelligence central core like 8200, how they have been accessing fundamentally important computer systems in America, other countries as well, I'm sure, and having this backdoor access. And what I wanted to do today was put this into a bigger picture of why it's happening and where it's planned to go. And to do that, we have to get through this whole idea that what I'm talking about is a, quote, Jewish plot. You hear some people say it's a Jewish plot, it's the Jews. But it ain't. What it is a secret society cult that I expose in detail in the trigger, which has hijacked the Jewish community. It's also hijacked Saudi Arabia. It's hijacked the Vatican and Roman Catholicism worldwide because it specializes in infiltration, in appearing to be one of the group it's infiltrated, appearing to be a supporter of the group or culture or community it's infiltrated, and manipulating itself into the leadership of these cultures, countries and religions, and yet not pursuing an agenda to the benefit of that it's supposed to represent, but for the benefit of the cult and its long-term agenda. Just very briefly, you can pick this story up in the 17th century with a guy called Sabbatai Zevi, hence Sabbatean, and he claimed to be a Jewish messiah. The Jewish messiah had come. And he operated in the Islamic-controlled Ottoman Empire. And he built up for the time, a massive following. And by the way, what I'm saying here has come from Jewish sources. People in the Jewish community who have realized they've been infiltrated and taken over and have tried to get that information out. So the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire says to Zevi, you either basically convert to Islam or we'll sort you out. So he did. And a lot of his followers did. And they became known as the Donne, which means to turn. And they operated as if they were following the Islamic religion while they were following the cult of Sabbatai Zevi. And what this cult does and did is to invert everything. And it inverted traditional Judaism in the sense that if it was a fast day in Judaism. In Sabbateanism, as it was known as then, it would become a feast day and so on and so forth. Everything got inverted. And if you look at the world in general today, what do you see? Constant inversion.
David Icke is probably one of the most insightful geniuses of our age. He has taken apart the world power system, and he goes on further with his speech about this control grid, this smart grid, with another clip. This is the second clip, but I'm going to put up on an embed on the site his complete presentation, and also Whitney Webb. I'm going to put up something that was done recently by Glenn Beck about her, about the power system also. But here we go with David Icke explaining a little bit more about how this smart grid, this power control system, is being put together.
This Sabbatean Frankist cult started to expand and expand its power as they infiltrated more and more areas. And I have a chapter in The Trigger called Atlantic Crossing, and that's describing how this Sabbatean Frankist cult moved in on America and infiltrated the intelligence network, CIA, etc., what is now known as the deep state with the Pentagon and so on, and also government administration. And this is where this fundamentally close relationship comes from, between the elite in Israel and the elite in America and the American administration. I mean, they own Donald Trump quite demonstrably. He gives them everything they ask for. And it's not the Israeli people and the American people. It's different arms of the same cult. You know, the American government gives Israel more foreign aid than any other country in the world, and it's what, just a smear of land in the Middle East by comparison to the rest of the world. It gives them, for instance, some $3.8 billion a year in military aid, a lot of which, as Whitney Webb points out, is actually spent on advancing this cyber control of this whole smart arena, including the infiltration of American computer systems. The point is, however, I hear people say, oh yeah, the American government, it gives the Jews $3.8 billion a year. No, it doesn't. You know, when you talk to people in the Israeli Jewish community in Israel, they are suffering deprivation and oppression by their elite in the same way as in other countries around the world. It's not the rank and file Jewish Israelis that are getting the 3.8 billion. It's the Sabbatean Frankist elite that controls Israel and suppresses the people of Israel in the way I've described, just as it does in other parts of the world. So here we have this this cult, actually a death cult if you go deep enough, which infiltrates different communities, poses as them, and in the public arena, in the way the media describes the world and reports the world, you have this group, different to this group, different to this group, different to this group, and everything apart from everything else. When if you go deep in the shadows, this cult is controlling that group, that group, that group, and that group by posing as that group when they are really all together seeking to advance a particular agenda. And one of the themes, of course, one of the things that this Sabbatean Frankist cult, some of them believe it. I think the inner core don't believe it, but it suits them as a way of manipulating what they want, which is global control. They talk about the fact that the day is coming when the Jewish Messiah will arrive. And of course, with the background to Sabbatai Zevi and Jacob Frank, you can see the connection between Sabbatai and Frankism, the cult, and the whole Jewish Messiah belief. They say that a world ruler is coming, a Jewish Messiah that will control the world, rule the world out of Israel, Israel, Jerusalem. And when you look at that before recent times, you would obviously say, that's bloody mad. That could never happen. How could that possibly happen? That's ridiculous. But now, as you start to see two things. One, the emergence of the smart grid, which is that's why all this technology and ways of doing things now, everything's called smart because it's all connected to this grid. The idea is that everything eventually is controlled by artificial intelligence. This is where the Internet of Things comes from, where all these devices, right down to your fridge and whatever, are being connected to the Internet. But also, if you take it further, you see that people like Ray Kurzweil, the Google executive in Silicon Valley, and others are talking now openly about the day coming. He gives the year around 2030, but coming when the human brain will be connected to artificial intelligence and to this smart grid. Now, whoever controls centrally, as this unfolds, as they describe, the smart grid will control everything connected to it. Ultimately, as they talk about, eventually the human brain via AI. In other words, AI becomes human perception and not human thought and emotional response that we take for granted today. Now, add that to the fact, going into Whitney Webb's work, that this vast and it's moving so fast, this vast and ever-increasing connection, network, web of Israeli cybersecurity companies and other cyber companies, connected as they are into the Israeli military and intelligence network through Unit 8200 and Mossad and Shin Bet. And the fact, and I've quoted Netanyahu at some length at a point in the trigger, and all I'm doing is simply publishing what he said about the intention to basically become number one tech center in the world. So we have this Beersheba military complex, cyber military complex, all around it. Now and increasing all the time again are the research and development research and development centers of major Silicon Valley corporations, all the big ones. And the idea I suggest, having researched this at great length, is that the plan is that the center of this smart grid will be Israel. And from that control potential comes the ability to control everything. And so I would emphasize again, am I saying that this is a Jewish plot on the world? No, I'm not. I'm saying the opposite, in fact. What I'm saying is this Sabbatean Frankist cult, which has infiltrated and taken control of the Jewish community, as well as others. I mean, the Saudi royal family, if you follow their story back, they are Donmeh. They are infiltrators, which have taken control of Saudi Arabia with the help of the British and the Americans, of course, sits back in amazement, can't believe it. So just because we see certain things on the surface and certain people appear and groups and countries appear to be in opposition, doesn't mean at the level of the cult that they are. They're working as one unit. And so suddenly the ability for a quote world ruler symbolically out of Israel becomes more and more credible and possible if the control of this smart grid is eventually located in Israel, which is where it's currently going. They have a tremendous detailed program in Israel of picking out cyber people, cyber talented people in the universities. When they go into the military under conscription, they then go into these cyber units and they develop skills and they develop knowledge of systems being developed by the military. And then they, and this is not me speaking, by the way, I'm quoting people like Netanyahu here and others. They then leave the military, quote, and they go and they start their own companies, or they go into companies already there in places like Silicon Valley. And Israel is now known as the startup nation. In fact, there's an organization called Startup Nation Central, I think it's called, which is funded to the tune of tens of millions of dollars by Paul Singer, who is a major, they call them vulture capitalists in the United States. And this is funding tech companies starting up and then becoming major players in the global smart cyber world. So this is how what Whitney Webber's been talking about connects into the bigger picture of this attempt to create this global centralized dictatorship that I've been writing about for 30 years. I'm talking about this cult that's infiltrated the Jewish community, as it's infiltrated Saudi Arabia, as it's infiltrated the Roman Church. The Roman Church is the relocated Church of Babylon anyway, if you follow the history back.
Going to end up this first hour of tonight with a presentation by Jay Dyer and his wife, and they're going to be talking about witchcraft and so forth, and some of the modern organizations that have sprung out of some of those ancient established traditions of witchcraft and so forth. But they are really into in detail about these subjects, these types of occult subjects. But here we go with Jay Dyer and his wife and talking in depth. And I'll also put up and embed on the site their complete presentation. So here we go next.
Welcome to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis, and I'm here with Jamie Hanshaw. And we're going to be talking about the hottest growing religion out there, and that's appropriate because we cover cults, mind control, alternative religions, sects, and groups all the time, because those are often used by the power elite to steer us into a new direction. You know, even antinatalism from Extinction Rebellion, the Green Agenda, all those things are kind of bound up with the New Age, with worshiping Gaia. And one of those recent religions, and I say recent because we're going to find out the real history of Wicca and many of the offshoots of you know, goddess worship and whatnot, they're not actually that old. I'm not saying that there weren't ancient witches. There were, but ancient and medieval witchcraft doesn't really have a connection to today's religious movements known as Wicca and the so-called traditional witchcraft movements. What I want to talk about is their real origins and the socio-cultural impacts that they have. If you go and you read about rising religions, religious trends, you'll find out that especially amongst Zoomers and even millennials, the fastest growing religion, supposedly according to the mainstream media, is witchcraft and Wicca. And it's, I think, tied into the decline of patriarchy and the rise of feminism and a society that's geared more and more towards what we might call feminine ideas or equalitarianism. So the loss of the patriarchy or the loss of the father archetype goes along with the loss of order, structure, logos, and the rise of the feminine or the rise of the goddess. And that, I think, is not accidental. I think it's by design. So we're going to get Jamie to give us some insights on the history and the rise of witchcraft.
Well, we're going to do Defense Against the Dark Arts class today.
Okay.
And, well, because we've studied a lot, along with Wicca, we've also studied Rosicrucian, Manly P. Hall, Emerald Tablets, Philosophical Research Society, what else? Hermetics. Just all of that.
Yeah, Neoplatonism, alchemy, all that.
Right. Freemasonry, Egyptology, Golden Dawn OTO. And all of these things have roots in the same ideologies. And we are going to show today that the newest trend is going to be witchcore, I think. What do you think?
Well, if you go on TikTok, the hottest videos don't have anything to do with anything in based in reality. It's what crystals give you sex energy. So this is what all the people who are 17, 18, 19 are watching, especially women. They're getting into their crystals and getting sex power from crystals. So that's what everybody who's, 25 and under is watching on social media.
Yeah. So 10 years ago, I wrote a book about princess programming, and all of that stuff came true. I linked that to androgyny. All that stuff came true. And now we are going to be seeing the rise of your traditional classic witch, along with the aesthetic of ugliness, is going to be rolled into that.
Well, that's relevant because the archetype of the witch is the hag, mm-hmm. right? And the old hag who's childless, barren, sterile, and there's then the notions of she consumes the children in some way. And those myths, those stories have a basis in reality because did an interview with a professor this week on my channel, and we were talking about, he did a history of witchcraft from a biological and sociological perspective, and he was talking about how this is really the predecessor to modern feminism and to abortion, is what witches were doing, in the 15th, 16th century.
And also we are going to link it to the music industry and the fashion industry, and they say that fashion is the witch's greatest friend. And we saw all of that play out with the Balenciaga scandals mm-hmm. and the people that were linked to that. So you're going to be seeing more of this come out in fashion, goat's heads, blood, bodily fluids, nasty things, even more.
Well, Target, right, just did a bunch of this, right?
Yes, and we'll get into Target deeply when we get to the end and the point of what we're making in the show.
Okay.
So it's going to be gore. It's going to be...
What's
going to
be gore?
The fashion trends.
The coming fashion trends.
Yes. We're okay. Predicting coming fashion trends is witchcore, gore, goat's heads, androgyny.
But isn't it already here?
It is.
It's going to get more popular?
But you're going to be seeing it more and more.
Okay.
So right now it's in the high fashion world. It's in elite Hollywood. It's at Met Gala. But... now it's at Target.
Now it spills down.
Exactly. Yeah, right. It trickles down to Target, and it's going to be in the lower levels of culture right. very soon. Your little niece is going to be wearing a pointy hat and riding a broomstick for mm-hmm. fashion reasons.
Right? Well, and Harry Potter kind of was a big part of making yes. this popular. I mean, I know that was just kind of, young adult fiction, but what I'm saying is that it really opened the gate. And even at that time, I remember reading that a lot of the occult societies and secret societies were actually thanking J.K. Rowling for opening up a lot of people to the possibilities of getting into witchcraft, especially that younger generation.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember that 1993 Disney movie Hocus Pocus?
Yes.
And in the original movie, it was the three children who defeated the evil witches, who were trying to steal their life force, their adrenochrome, their essence.
Yeah, so kind of right? Still in the essence of the young. Yeah.
Yes, and so the sequel came out in 2022, and the entire narrative is kind of skewed in a way because it was very different where the Witch Sisters return to the future. They're local heroes now.
Right.
And they're emulated by the townspeople, and all of the townspeople dress up as them and portray them in the talent competition.
Yeah, and the new Hocus Pocus, witchcraft is now normalized.
Right.
And it surprises the witches when they come back, right?
Yes. And the three teen girls in Hocus Pocus 2 have to empathize with the witches and carry on their traditions instead of defeating them.
Right.
right?
Yeah, and of course Disney, too, had a huge role in the last 20, 30 years of pushing witchcraft, too, because a lot of this, you'll notice, is not it comes along with a bunch of other cultural engineering, culture steering, which I think comes out of Tavistock, and a lot of that comes out of Stanford Research, and that's tied to the gender stuff, right? So the idea that there are these mystical transcendent forces that we can tap into and magically become anything we want to become, magical thinking, that's essentially postmodernism. So the philosophical ideologies of postmodernism are often connected to these new religious movements and the idea of magical thinking.
Mm-hmm. So since you mentioned Disney, let's look at what the kids are watching, a new show called Pauline. Pauline is a typical teenager struggling to balance school with thoughts about crumbling society and the ongoing climate crisis. Things get more complicated when she becomes pregnant after a one-night stand with a boy named Lucas, who just happens to be Satan. Pauline follows the pair's complicated love story. So this is coming out on Disney Plus for little kids. There's also a cartoon that is an FX show on Disney Plus called Little Demon 2022.
Well, they were putting Crowleyan themes in cartoons, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Right.
Like literal Crowley phrases.
So Little Demon is about a girl whose mom got impregnated by Satan and tried to unalive her at birth. But then she saw that the baby was a girl and decided to keep it. And so now Satan is the absentee father trying to get his daughter back. And the mom is a Baphomet character and has tattoos all over her and is very like muscular like a man but with breasts, and there's actually a scene where the mom gets naked and does a in cartoon version does a spell to go to the other side, and she looks exactly like Baphomet.
Well, Baphomet is a image that conjures up a transcendence of biology and gender, right? Mm-hmm. So it has both genders, because the idea in a lot of the alchemical and Neoplatonic tradition is that there's a higher status that we all kind of fell from. And so there was a point at some, you know, primeval stage or some golden era where we were above man and woman. We were something higher, some being that had either both genders or no gender, right? And so falling into genderhood, a la the Neoplatonic idea, then put us into this situation where man's problems, humanity's problems, result from being different. And so if we can make everything kind of unique and the same, if we can get rid of everything being unique and make everything kind of homogenized, then we could get rid of all the battles and the warfare and the distinctions that we have, right? Toxic masculinity is what causes, you know, society to go to war. And if we could just make men more feminine and women more masculine, we could all kind of be this equal type of thing, this new creature, this new goblin. Don't go anywhere. This is the Alex Jones Show, and we're talking about the rise of witchcraft and why it's a problem. Welcome back to the Auction Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis, and I'm here with my wife, Jamie, and we are talking about the rise of witchcraft as the most popular religious trend amongst the young, amongst Zoomers, and we're talking about why that might be, and is this actually just part of social engineering and steering us into a society more amenable to the technocratic order and what the global elite want? I think that's absolutely the case. In fact, modern so-called Wicca is not an ancient religion. It's a retooled, repackaged, recreated thing from Gerald Gardner and Aleister Crowley.
Didn't you say he just liked to smack butts?
Yeah, well, that comes from what he would get the witches naked, sky-clad, out in the woods and just spank them with switches. So that was what Gerald Gardner was really... was really interested. It had nothing to do with trying to find some mystical powers. It was just a cult, right?
Yeah.
It's just a way to set up, you know, mind control, you know, fleecing operations with covens, basically.
And, you know, witchcraft isn't all lavender herbs and crystals. It's disgusting things, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's this idea that there's a white magic and then there's black magic and you can do white magic. But no, actually, all magic is really just delusion. It's deception. And it's just putting you into a ridiculous situation to believe in irrational things and be controlled by forces far above you that are highly deceptive and highly manipulative. And I don't just mean the demons. I'm talking about on the human sphere as well. Like a lot of these cults, a lot of these religious groups are actually part and parcel of pushing us into an elite structure that a control mechanism of the Great Reset and all that. So all of these things actually, for example, any nature worship tradition is absolutely amenable to the Great Reset because it's going to get us into this idea that humanity needs to be depopulated for Mother Earth. We've got to have a global government for Mother Earth, et cetera. So even the alien cults, they all say the same thing.
Well, I realize some of my examples might be a little outdated, elder millennial, talking about Madonna and Katy Perry and stuff like that.
What about the younger people?
Yeah, so I have these Gen Z witches. First one is Abigail Breslin, the little girl from Science. You remember her?
Mm-hmm.
So she's all grown up now, and she is a singer with an alter ego named Sophomore, and she describes herself as a very witchy person and comes from a long line of witchy women with psychic medium abilities. There is a up-and-coming TikTok star named Ash Nico, who is very open about being a witch on her TikToks. There is a girl called Melanie Martinez, who has also many of the symbols of monarch mind control. She's got the split-dyed hair. She's got the alter personalities. On her album called K through 12, her alter goes through a portal with an immortal angel named Lilith. And Lilith is a higher up spirit in witchcraft and Satanism.
Yeah, well, Lilith is associated with child sacrifice and abortion.
Right. So this is a demon from the Talmud, a succubus. This is who's leading Melanie Martinez through the portals.
She's also mentioned in Isaiah. So she's mm-hmm. actually in the text of Isaiah. Lilith is.
And she's also mentioned in, I think, Epic of Gilgamesh or one of those like mm-hmm. Anunnaki tales. They mm-hmm. also talk about her. Her album Crybaby is an extraterrestrial looking thing. So we were talking about the Baphomet earlier with the fusion of different species, different genders, different
genetic modification. Yeah.
So she has an extraterrestrial looking altar and, then you have Bella Porch is also another one with the witchcraft symbolism. And Emma Watson, Hermione from Harry Potter.
He for she.
Thanks her coven of witches for supporting her.
Yes, in fact, thanks to Brittany Selner for pointing out that Emma Watson recently announced that she was initiated into witchcraft. And she has announced that on her, I think her Instagram or something. But we were just talking about this notion of feminism and Luciferianism with Selner from a more cultural perspective, and Jamie's giving us the breakdown from more of an occult, an esoteric perspective. So you have culture and you have occulture. So we're talking about the occulture today. But yeah, so here you have a younger pop stars as well, also representing this. So it's not just the older generation of the Madonnas and the Britney Spears and the Katy Perrys. It's the new ones as well. And, why do you think that they reach a certain level and then they get reached out to join it? Or do you think that they go seeking it out? Do you think they're recruited, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
I think they want to fit in with the culture, and that includes what we're talking about.
But, I mean, do you think that they're paid to do this, or do you think that they're recruited into it and really initiated into it?
Yes, I think they're really initiated into mm-hmm. it and paid to do it. So it's a win-win. In their mind, mm-hmm. it's a win-win.
Right.
But these things used to be more hidden even, 10, 20 years ago. You'd have to.
Well, but now you could be openly a witch, openly a Satanist. I mean, for a lot of these groups, abortion is a sacrament, mm-hmm. right? So it's,